This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. Well, this is an exciting day. I have two really great interviews. First up will be Daniel Silva, and then at the bottom of the hour, an old favorite, Ace Atkins, who's been on the program many times, and so I'm going to be talking to both of them today. This is one of those really special days. But before I get the call in from New York, because that's where Daniel Silva is, and he is, of course, if you've been watching any television lately, he's been on every show because his book is so relevant, all about Russia. So we'll be talking to him. But I do want to remind everyone that August 1st is the deadline for the 6th annual self-published ebook awards on Writer's Digest. Go to Writer's Digest, you should always be checking out their contests. And this one, the deadline is August 1st, and it's for all of you self-published people out there and self-published ebooks. It's a wonderful, wonderful contest. The cash prize is $5,000. And of course, the biggest thing is that you will get a trip to New York City. You'll get to meet all sorts of wonderful people, and you will get, a big write-up in Writer's Digest. And for your career, wow, that can make you. So it's just wonderful. And there are an additional $13,000 in prizes for all of you people who don't make first prize. So do have a look at the Writer's Digest contest. And I think you would, you always have to try. That's the important thing in life with all writers. You can't give up. You have to keep trying. And so it's always exciting when you win a prize. And boy, oh boy, my next guest has won, I think, every prize. And I'm so very, very thrilled that, there are authors who I love, and then there are authors who I just adore. And so I think Daniel Silva really follows right in that line, because I have been reading him since his very first book came out. And I thought that was fantastic. And then, woo! And is Daniel on?
Hi.
Okay, well, I've just been talking about you because I told everybody that I just love you. I love you for lots of reasons. First, because your name's Daniel, and my son's name is Daniel, so that's my favorite name. Then you were born in Detroit, and I'm a Michigander. I'm from the Upper Peninsula. I'm a Youper. And I know, although you didn't live there, you only lived in Michigan, I think, till you were about, what, 7 or 8?
Yep.
Yeah, but still, Michigander's a Michigander.
A Michigander's a Michigander. Every time I go there, I remember how great it is to be in Michigan in the summertime.
It is.
I have fond memories of Michigan in the summertime.
Did you ever get to the Upper Peninsula?
I of course. And in fact, I was just, there's a great series up in Traverse City that I went to. Gosh, about 5 years ago now, in the summertime. It was wonderful.
Well, Michiganders love to read, because with our long winters especially, we read a lot. And so, wow, what can I say about you? I also love you because I started reading you, of course, when your first book came out, The Unlikely Spy. But I love, of course, Gabriel Alon, because my husband's from Israel. So you are also my husband's favorite author, and we've been reading you since book one, and every time a book comes out, we're like eager to read it. And of course, a new book, and you've been all over the place talking about it, because you are so clever. I mean, who else comes out with a book about Russia right when there's a big summit, and so you really...
I want to thank President Trump and President Putin for scheduling their summit meeting on the day that my book was published. That was very kind of them.
I think so, too. I think it's really, you know, but of course they know that you are such a brilliant writer and that you would have so much to say about Russian involvement in lots of hanky-panky. And it's so funny. That's one way of putting it. And it's so funny because, you know, I was not going to... I love the slow reveal. And so I wasn't actually going to mention at all. I wasn't going to mention Kim Philby.
We can talk about Kim Philby.
You know, I like to, when I read, I never read the publicity before it. I never read even what the publicists send me about the book. I never read any of that. I don't read the blurbs because I want to just enjoy the book from the first sentence.
Okay.
So I wasn't going to mention Kim Philby because I thought, well, people should discover that he's in the book. But it's so funny because now, of course, everybody knows that there's something to do with Kim Philby in this book. And when you look back on it, you are so amazing. You have such knowledge about Kim Philby and about Russia. Do you sometimes just wonder, why am I not the head of the CIA and the FBI, both?
The last thing that I want to do, or frankly, the last thing that the country needs is for me to be running an intelligence service. I'm doing what I want to do. But that said, I take these, you know, my work very seriously, and I take these issues very seriously. I am well connected in Washington policy and security circles. I know people at the highest ranks of government, politics, and intelligence. And I, you know,
that's why your books have so authentic and why they are so compelling.
Well, thank you so much for that. I take it seriously. That said, I have to, you know, make sure that first and foremost that the books are works of entertainment, and they are works of entertainment, and they are something to take on a plane, take to the beach, turn the page. But they are based on a great amount of thought and research, and I do take my work very seriously.
Well, they certainly are page turners, and I love so many things about your writing: how clear you are, how precise you are, the way you use the language, and I always have really admired how you are able to do that slow reveal, and that's right from the very beginning, in the first book about Gabriel Allon, where he isn't introduced in the beginning. It's the first chapter is told through the eyes of a young boy. And
well, I like to sometimes develop my characters, as I call it, from the outside in. And so use techniques of and points of view to watch the character and then move slowly from how others see him to how he sees himself and the world around him. It's just a technique that I really enjoy using, and I use it on Gabriel frequently, actually.
Well, in the first book, of course, which is The Kill Artist, where you introduce him, why don't you tell people, I don't know anybody who doesn't know all about him, but why don't you tell the listeners who don't know about Gabriel how it started, the story
of how he came to be.
Yeah.
I mean, he appeared in a book called The Kill Artist in 2000. I think the most interesting aspect about Gabriel, he was an Israeli intelligence officer and assassin who had a very interesting cover job. He is at that time was one of the world's finest art restorers. He's the chief of Israeli intelligence now, but he was worked for many, many years as undercover as an art restorer. That was his cover job. But the most intriguing thing about Gabriel, now 18 books later, is the fact that he was not created to as a continuing character. He was supposed to appear in one book and one book only, and then sail off into the sunset, never to be seen or heard from again. And obviously, it didn't turn out that way. But I built him to appear in one book and one book only. In fact, he was supposed to sort of be a second tier character in that first book, and he took over that book. My publisher asked me to write another one. I did. My publisher asked me to write a third. I did. And at that point, I had a series on my hands.
And now we are up to number 18 with The Other Woman. Wow. Wow. And 18 is high, and it means it's a really good luck number. And so, wow, this is, I think it's already shot. It has to be the best-selling book in the country because everybody wants to read it. And the wonderful thing is that, as we said, it's so timely. It has, for people who aren't aware or sort of dimly aware of some of the things that have been going on over the past 50 years, 60 years, or even all the way back to the 1930s, the book is an eye-opener.
Well, what I wanted to accomplish with this book is to sort of put what's going on now in historical context. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind, to remember, is that when Vladimir Putin tries to undermine our democracy, when he meddles in our politics, when he meddles in British politics, when he assassinates his opponents overseas, when he engages in black propaganda and disinformation campaigns and influence campaigns, he's not making this up. This is nothing new for the Russians and the KGB. The Russian intelligence services have been engaging in this sort of work since the 1920s and 1930s. They're called active measures. They've been perfecting the art of disinformation and influence campaigns for a very, very long time, and they're very good at it, and that's quite obvious. They have made a mess of our politics. We are crippled as a result of this. Our president is damaged, our political system is damaged, and trust me, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, his intelligence services are loving every minute of it.
Exactly. And the funny thing is, I was really, one thing about Kim Philby, of course, he's an important part of this book, and for people, younger people who aren't aware of what he did and who he is, it's a fascinating way and a wonderful way to learn history. And as you said, they've been doing this forever. Now, Kim Philby, tell us what he did. He bought what did he buy when he what did he use his money to buy? Karl Marx, right?
Oh! Well, when he graduated from Cambridge, when he left Cambridge in 1933, he won a history prize. I think he was awarded £14 for this prize, and he used the money to buy the complete works of Karl Marx. By 1933, he was a committed communist.
Well, this is funny, you know.
In 1934, he was recruited as a KGB asset. By 1940, he was working inside British intelligence as a double agent. In 1949, he was sent to Washington as the MI6's head of station in Washington. He had access to all of our important secrets during that time. He gave them all to the Russians. He defected to Moscow in 1963 and lived there for the remainder of his life. When he worked on and off for the KGB. And this book is sort of a piece of speculative fiction about something that Philby might have done during the last years of his life.
Because as a brilliant writer, you found a gap in his history and you filled it in. That's the wonderful thing about it. And it, I wanted to tell you, it's so funny. When I was 17, okay, because I've been reading since I was three, like Beatrix Potter started reading when she was three. And when I was 17, I bought the complete works of Karl Marx. Now, it's so funny. And my romance with communism lasted as long as it took me to read the book, because he was a horrible man. But what really is interesting is that when my father found out, he said, he's had some very choice words for me, but he explained to me that when in the 1930s, his best friend, family went to Russia. They were, as I said, we were from the Upper Peninsula. And even then, as you mentioned, the communists, the Russians were all over trying to spread disinformation. And so they came up to the northern part of Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and they told all these people, move to Russia because you get free permanence, women get equal pay, and everything's beautiful in Russia. And his best friend, who he was very close to, they got all their possessions together and headed off to Moscow and never to be heard from again. So it was a lesson. Well, he said,
one of the things that I explore in the novel is the degree to which Moscow has had this sort of outsized impact on the West for over 100 years now. I mean, it was the North Star for the global communist movement, and now under Putin, it is once again playing that sort of leading light role, but for a new kind of person, and that's someone on the right now. A lot of people on the far right really look up to and admire Vladimir Putin. He has lots of followers in Western Europe, lots of far-right political parties who receive support from him and money and look to him for inspiration. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people in this country who see much to admire in Vladimir Putin. And, you know, during the campaign and even during his presidency, Donald Trump has said very kind things about Vladimir Putin. And I really don't understand that, because Vladimir Putin is a stone cold killer. He is the head of a kleptomaniacal regime that is stealing the riches of Russia. He's quite possibly the richest man in the world, which is quite an accomplishment for someone who's never worked outside government. So I guess that's one of the things that bothers me about this whole situation, is I really don't think we should be trying to get along with Vladimir Putin, because he runs against the core values of the United States. I think that we need to be countering Vladimir Putin and containing Vladimir Putin and trying to undo and fight against this sort of new authoritarianism that is rising around the globe.
Well, as an expert on espionage and all of this, don't you sort of wish that we had a James Jesus Angleton out there?
You know what? James Jesus Angleton was by no means a perfect person.
Oh, no, not at all.
He made some terrible mistakes, and he crippled the CIA with his mole hunts. We're referring to the legendary deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who was a very close friend of Kim Philby and had lunch with him a couple of days a week when Philby was here in Washington. And Philby stole all of Angleton's secrets, and Angleton, who was the head of counterintelligence at the CIA, never had any clue that Kim Philby was a Russian agent. So his legacy is forever checkered by that association.
Well, this is the problem. You know, we go through these. There, he was paranoid about moles, okay, and
sure.
And then he had a mole right there next to him, and then we have the current situation where we don't know who is what anymore, and it's really confusing.
Well, that's why I wrote the book that I wrote.
Well, that's why I think people should read it, because the other woman, you really are able to talk there about the things that's sort of a warning that we have to pay attention to what is happening in the world, and to understand that this has been going on for a long time, and we have to really worry about it.
I think that the old KGB under ruthless directors like Yuri Andropov, they would never dare to imagine that the operation could have succeeded the way it has. And I mean, our institutions and our politics are this week a flaming wreck. Never in my life did I ever think that I would live to see the day when the New York Times had on its front page an article wondering whether the President of the United States was a traitor, or that a New York Times columnist would openly call the President of the United States a traitor and that he was an asset of Russian intelligence.
And then
we are through the looking glass.
Yes.
We are in uncharted territories, and the strain on our system right now is incredible.
And it maybe should be pointed out, too, that Kim Philby acted as a journalist. And do you have a collection of all of the articles that he wrote?
Not his articles, but what I do have is I have a library that contains several thousand books, and I have every serious book written about MI6 and British intelligence, and every book ever written on the Philby affair. So I'm researching Kim Philby.
And no, of course, the wonderful thing about it is that you make it so compelling, your because of your insights into Kim Philby, and the entire story, of course, about Gabriel Alon. And I was so happy, at least, that he had some happy moments in this story, in the book, with his family, his new family. And it's just, Gabriel is a wonderful, wonderful creation, and you've just been carrying it through 18 books, and I know you'll do it again. So I'm just really honored that you came on the program today.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And I know that you're going to have a great success with this, and with all of your books. I want to tell everybody that also they should also go back, and I have just recently, because the Audible versions are absolutely amazing. And
I appreciate that. Thank
and you. I think that people should... They can start with The Kill Artist, and because you have a wonderful narrator, George Gidall, amazing. He captures the tone and the voice exactly. It's what I imagined the books would sound like, and so I was really thrilled.
He is a very, very prominent narrator and of audiobooks, and he's won numerous awards for the Alon series. So we love George.
Oh, absolutely. And I tell everyone, you know, read this book. The Other Woman is the new book, and it's very, really current and hot with the current news. But go back, and every one of your books, and particularly number four, I think that was your fourth book, which really meant a great deal to me, because Death in Vienna. I had just been to Poland when I read that book shortly after, so it was really very, very moving. So everybody read all 18 of Daniel Silva's books, okay?
Okay, thank you so much, Patsy.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye now. Okay, well, you know, one of the things is, and this is funny, because as you're reading Daniel Silva's book, and you're thinking about, you think about what he writes in there, and of course, as I mentioned, and he writes in the book about the fact that Kim Philby, who was the biggest spy ever, acted as a journalist, and he wrote many articles. I've got many years. I've been sort of very much like Daniel Silva, interested in Kim Philby, probably it started because of my interest in communism, and I realized that it's stupid, and Karl Marx was a horrible person. And I worked for a number of years. I was in the British Library reading room, and everybody would, you know, point out, there's Karl Marx's chair. That's where he sat, and that's where he wrote so much of his books. And it is interesting. Of course, Karl Marx also was a reporter. And so you have to sort of take everything. I know, you know, it's nice that we have all the things in the news, but you have to take everything with a little bit of reflection, because if, as we know, the KGB or the new version of the KGB is everywhere, we have to assume that they are everywhere, and that's in our businesses. Certainly, in our businesses, we have to look at that. And the horrible thing is that we haven't been looking at everything. And maybe if you read The Other Woman, you will get some ideas. But I also go back to some of Daniel Silva's other books, because there are cautionary tales in there about what the Russians are doing, and of course now what the Chinese are doing, what this one's doing, what that one's doing. But it's a great read just in and of itself. So we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Ace Atkins.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I, or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Patsy, how are you doing?
Okay, great. Well, last time I had you on, we were talking about your other persona. That's when you were channeling Spencer Brooks. And So I'm so thrilled now to have you back here to talk about the new Quinn Colson book. You were also on when The Innocents came out. You know, you just managed to keep this whole town going here. I mean, you have really created such a rich and varied personalities in this town that I can see how you are able to keep it fresh.
Well, it's, you know, I think that's the fun of this series. You know, it's not just about one character or one man that you're following and his thing. It's really about a whole community. It's about a whole county. And so I have no shortages of stories to tell.
Well, that's for sure. And as you said, you have so many wonderful characters in there. And that, of course, your readers, the first novel, The Rangers, of course, introduced us to Quinn, and about the fact that he was a ranger and that he served in Afghanistan and Iraq and sort of laid the foundation. And then, of course, his wonderful, and this is, I think, one of the best characters, of course, is Lily, who is just, you have created such a wonderful, strong character, female character here.
Well, thanks. That's something I wanted to do from the get-go. It's very important to me. I think, with people who read thrillers or crime novels, I mean, honestly, so many male authors make the mistake of, they really write terrible female characters, and they often have them as sex objects, or they have them as the damsel in distress, or, and that kind of stuff. And for me, my background as a journalist and covering law enforcement, that kind of thing, is I was very fortunate to meet a lot of strong women who worked in that world in law enforcement as cops and detectives. They were just fantastic, and I had to represent them authentically, and that's where Lily Virgil came about.
Well, she is a great character. Of course, in the last book, she took over as sheriff. The last book opened so dramatically with this horrific girl on fire. It was one of the most frightening openings for a book I ever read. And then this one, of course, opens with a bank robbery. A little bit more humor here, but that you managed to put into a bank robbery.
Sure.
But it was, of course, another dramatic entry into this world of the people in this community. So tell them a little bit more about the book, what you want to reveal. Because there's some things we don't want to reveal. We want them to read it. But what do you want to reveal about this
book? Well, The Fallen is number 7 in the Quinn Colson book. Books about Tippahawk County, Mississippi, and Tippahawk County, Mississippi, I think is a fictional county, but certainly very accurate and true to this part of the country, very true to the Deep South. And that's really what I wanted to do, is I wanted to take a rural county, and I wanted to be able to use that as far as the people, the history, the background of it, to move a lot of stories through. And it's not just a, crime of the week or whatever, but crime certainly does come to that county, and it does, affect the people. And in this particular book, it starts off with a trio of bank robbers knocking off a small rural bank in Jericho, Mississippi, which is in Tippahawa County. And they do it with a lot of style and kind of an unusual manner. They're actually dressed up as Donald Trump when they rob the bank, and they say some things that I cannot repeat on radio. But that kicks off the book, and the question is they do it so effectively and so good. Quinn is a former Army Ranger, recognizes that these guys had some military training, and the book begins from there.
And it's one action after another, and it's very exciting. And then, of course, so many of your other characters, that have come through the book. So although it's a standalone, I always tell, as a matter of fact, I don't have to tell people to start at the beginning, because when I had CJ Box on, I asked him to recommend somebody to read other than himself. And he said, well, everybody should read Ace Atkins' book, and they should start with The Ranger.
Yeah, what a good guy. I appreciate that. And he's one of my favorite writers. I know CJ, and he's a buddy of mine, but I'm a big fan of his books. And I think if you read those books, Joe Pickett books, as far as the way that they are, they stand on their own, but also you can read them. You get more out of them as you read all of them, and you see the whole family dynamic, and you see how things from the past sometimes play into the present. And that's really what I wanted to do with Quinn Colson and his world in Mississippi.
Well, I agree, because I love the C.J. Pickett family. When I interviewed him the first time, many of my female listeners didn't understand that there was this female component to it. They thought it was just going to be a Western book, and they liked that, and they appreciated that, and they started reading it because of that. And I said in, like, with your book, I think women will relate very much to Lily, because she is strong, and that's the that's the way most women think of themselves.
Well, so, and I think that CG Box has terrific female characters in this book, everywhere from throughout the series. He really is a singular example, I think, in that world, as far as writing exciting thrillers where you do have strong male characters, but you also have strong female characters as well. But certainly that's something that, you have to be aware of, which is the truth is most of your readers are women. I think that women probably are, there's probably a point where they're going to be reading a book, and if they're anything like my wife, they're going to see what the hero is doing. They're going to roll their eyes a little bit. And so, you know, we've got to be true to reality. And like I said, in my line of work where I was covering a lot of law enforcement, a lot of wonderful, strong women that I met in that world.
And of course, I have to remind all my listeners that, of course, you were here in Tampa. So we have a great affection for you because you were right here in Tampa working at, which newspaper was it then? It's changed so many times.
Well, I started out, I was originally at St. Petersburg Times just as a lowly correspondent, and then I became full-time staff writer for several years at the now-defunct Tampa Tribune. But it was a great experience, wonderful stuff. At some point, I'm probably going to go back and write about Florida at some point, but being here in Mississippi and writing about the Deep South, which is where I was born and where my family is from, is very seductive to me. But Florida is as well. I think at some point I'll probably go back to writing about Florida because I really miss that world and rich, talk about rich, crazy characters.
Well, we have plenty of rich. Well, we have rich characters in many ways.
Yep, absolutely.
Of course, I should mention that you were nominated for a Pulitzer Prize while you were working here at the newspaper. And so we are all very proud of you. If ever you decide to come back and do research here, then you have to come over to the studio here in Clearwater, because, of course,
you know how
beautiful Clearwater is.
Oh, my gosh. It's funny. When I started The Fallen, I had actually just gone down and I was at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading, which is one of the best festivals in the country. It's just terrific. And afterwards, I actually rented a house in Treasure Island, and I worked for about a week just getting into The Fallen, and that's where I started the book. So I always return back to Florida in some shape or form.
Okay, that's good. We like that. Speaking of strong female characters, you also did that in your, when we put your other hat on. I don't know, what kind of hat do you need when you're writing for Boston, when you're writing Robert B. Parker?
You just need a Red Sox cap.
Red Sox. Oh, well, of course. And there, you've really expanded Susan's role in those books.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in those, the people that, your listeners who know Susan Silverman from the Spencer novels, is one of the things when I started writing Spencer, when the estate hired me, is some of the complaints that I had seen from the readers is people, they didn't like Susan very much. And I actually had a note from the editor at the time said, don't worry about Susan. Don't put her in as much. People, she drives them crazy. And I really felt like, as a longtime reader of those books, is it wasn't a problem. I think with Susan, I think she didn't have enough to do, and I think that's what probably in some of the books, and the books that I really love Susan, she had more of an active role and was a stronger character. And so I, instead of going less Susan, I really ended up going more Susan, and I think that she just kind of reverted back to the way she was originally drawn by Mr. Parker, which is very strong, feisty, independent, and very intricate to the stories, and not just somebody that Spencer took out to dinner from time to time. And I wanted to make her a core part of the series, and I think I've been able to do
that. Oh, you've succeeded. I think it's made the dynamics of the relationship so much more interesting.
Well, thanks. I think it does, too. And I really, one of the ways that I did that is I was very fortunate when I was hired by the state. I was hired by Joan Parker herself. And Joan Parker was an amazing, you talk about a tough, independent, strong woman. That is Joan Parker. Oh, my gosh. And getting to know Joan Parker, who Bob always famously said was the original model for Susan, I just went back to any time I write about Susan, I think about Joan. And had I not been fortunate enough to have known Joan, I don't think I could be writing the series as effectively. She taught me a lot about those characters and a lot about that world, and I was really lucky to know her.
I think you've enhanced the entire series by increasing Susan's role, and I really love it, and I think most of the readers do too. From the people I've talked to, they always say, "Wow, they're so good. The books are so
great."
Often that when a writer takes over for another writer, the books just fall off. And in your case, it's, I think, just the opposite. You've done a wonderful.
Well, I love that character, and I take the job very seriously.
Yeah, and I think it shows.
It's not just a paycheck for me. I would not be doing what I do had I not been, if I was not a fan of Robert B. Parker's work. And so I feel very indebted to keeping that legacy alive, and I love doing it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, now, you know, of course, you are now, you're sort of wearing that hat of the Southern writer, of crime writer.
Yep.
that you've been crowned. They have to give you a crown here. Of course, it's funny, you don't sound Southern at all.
Well, it's a strange thing, and I get that. I did an interview recently with John Grisham, and we were talking, and he said, he's funny. He said, you don't sound Southern at all. And I've never had an accent. My dad did not have an accent, and it's just we have kind of a flat. My uncle, I think it's an Atkins family trait. I also, when I was a kid, I was born in Alabama, and I went to spend most of my life in Alabama, but for a few years when I was young, I lived different places as my dad's job took him to different areas as a football coach, and so I think that probably had something to do with it too. But I'll tell you, if I was actually talking to somebody trying to get a deal on a muffler or something, I could really play it up.
Yeah, I was going
to
say
I was trying to get a deal. Yeah, if I was trying to talk to somebody about getting a deal on something, I probably could play it up a little bit more.
Then you could be a good old boy.
Yeah, my dad didn't have that, and my grandfather didn't have that, and they were about as Alabama as you get. It's just it's a strange quirk. It's often very very regional.
Now, of course, you live in Oxford, Mississippi, which of course is the home of William Faulkner. Sort of, you're in the shadow there of William Faulkner. Did he have a big influence on you as a writer?
Yeah, definitely, and I think more so since I started living here. It was all, William Faulkner, of course, is the Mount Rushmore of great American writers and really great novelist, period, I was familiar with Faulkner, but probably more 20 years ago, more familiar with Faulkner in the way that you are from being force-fed to read Sound and the Fury. But living here, I digested all of Faulkner and really sought to understand him, and they're not easy books. They're very complex books, and he's not an easy person to understand, but I was fortunate to be in an area where a lot of people knew him. They knew him personally, and one of my very good friends was Dean Faulkner Wells, who is Faulkner's niece and was essentially raised by William Faulkner. And through that, you got to kind of know Faulkner beyond the postage stamp and the statue, and he was just a regular guy. He worked in Hollywood for a while. He liked to watch Charlie Chan movies, and he was kind of affable, kind of funny guy. He just was one of the geniuses of the 20th century. There's a lot. I mean, the whole idea behind the Quinn books of having a county that you have all this action and interrelated characters and family dynamics and histories and all that kind of stuff all came from inspiration by Faulkner.
You're right. When we're in high school, somewhere along the line, they sort of force feed a Faulkner, which I think turns people off. And it really does.
And the worst thing that they do is I know in college the first thing they had us read was Sound and the Fury, and it's a very complicated book, and it's very complicated as a professional writer. Now going back and seeing how he did it, and stylistically, it's a very experimental novel. It's a very complicated novel. It's you've really got to understand the what he's doing there. That's not a good thing to introduce to high school or college students, to get them to a love of the language.
So how do you recommend, what's a great introduction to Faulkner? How should we start with Faulkner?
It's a funny thing. Years ago when I first moved here and I was trying to really make a concerted effort, you can't live here and say you read Faulkner and not really read Faulkner. And I was reading Absalom and having somewhat of a difficult time getting through it. And I was buying some lumber at a local lumber yard. I bought a very, very old farmhouse, and I was helping with the renovation, bought some lumber, and I was bringing back the farmhouse. And the guy who was checking my tag at the lumber yard got out to make sure that, I got the right lumber and I didn't get more boards than I was supposed to. And he looked out, and he saw that Absalom was in my passenger seat. He said, that's a real good book, but I tell you what, he said, I always found The Unvanquished to be much more accessible. So I went back and I read the Unvanquished, and I was damned if he wasn't right. It was more accessible, and you kind of get into that understanding of Faulkner from that point of getting to understand what he's doing, and then you gradually move into something like The Sound of the Fury or Absalom, and you understand kind of the unleashed genius that he had. But anyway, so that's people continue to surprise you with their knowledge of Faulkner. So I think certain people that are maybe craftsmen and people that have that kind of skill level sometimes understand the genius of the writers like that. And one of the best writers here in the area and certainly nationally was Larry Brown. And Larry was completely self-educated and one of the most well-read people I've ever met in my life, and never went to college. And, for that matter, Faulkner didn't either.
But Ace, I want to thank you so much for being on today. I think that The Fallen, again, it's fresh. You manage to come out with new things all the time, and it's always exciting to read your books. And I want to thank you for being on to talk about The Fallen.
I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
And I know we're going to alternate, and we'll be back with, when's the next Spencer coming out?
Spencer, as always, will be back in May.
Okay. I look forward to talking to you in May with the next Spencer, okay?
Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye now. Okay, well, that was a oldie but goodie. You know, it's funny. My program is on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Tuesday is actually the perfect day because most large publishing houses publish their books on Tuesdays. So that's always the release date. And authors normally talk on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So it just turned out so well for me because I usually get the most famous authors because of the big publishing houses live on those days. But every once in a while, there is an author who doesn't do Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Ace Atkins is one. I generally get him on a Monday. And so this interview today that we just aired was an old one. And we should have aired the one that was done last Monday. And it's for the new book called The Sinners. So I'm going to have to play that next week. I will find some space in there to play that one because the new book, I love the new book for one reason, because it's a wedding book. Now, who expects an Ace Atkins book, you know, because it's always there's always so much going on and so much violence in some of it, this is a wedding book. And since this has been sort of the wedding season, what with the royal wedding, and I've been talking to a lot of people about weddings. So it was really it was really so much fun to read the new book. First of all, of course, Ace Atkins' mother is one of these Elvis Presley fans, and she keeps talking about Elvis Presley's wedding to Priscilla, and Ace Atkins actually goes out there and picks the roses and for the bouquet for his fiance's for the wedding. So I thought that was a sweet part. There is a lot of action and a lot of they use a lot of shotguns down there in Mississippi, and so you don't suffer from a lack of action. And the new book is called The Sinners, and it is available online, and it just came out. So I will play that next week, and that was also a great interview. I love him because we alternate between the Colson books and the ones that he does for Spencer, and I don't know how he can keep it all straight in his head, but he does, and he's really a wonderful guy, and I really enjoy talking to him. And meanwhile, I want to tell you, everybody, I have been looking at Publishers Weekly lately, and it is really amazing. Some of the deals that have been, some people have been getting big six-figure deals, and this is a place where you have to go. If you are looking for an agent, don't get one of those ABC books with all the list of, you know, agents, because half of them aren't current. And you want the active agents. You want the agents who are getting the deals. And if you want to know who they are, then go to publishersweekly.com. Check out, they have an area there called book deals. What else would you want? And there you will read about some of the book deals. And I've been reading, there's been so many, but there's one particular one I want to talk about. It's Kate Kessler. It's just funny how when they pitch to a publisher, you know, when an agent pitches to a publisher, they try to come out with something short and sweet, just like when you pitch a movie. And so Kate Kessler's the pitch that the agent used, who is Deirdre Knight at Knight Agency, a very lucky and clever woman, she used John Wick meets Taken. Simple. So what, by just doing that, John Wick meets Taken, the publisher knows what to expect. And in this new, in the Kate Kessler thriller called Seven Crows, that's what it was described as. And wow, we have a six-figure deal in there, and you will want to read the book when it comes out. But meanwhile, you might want to check Deirdre Knight at Knight Agency, who represented Kessler, and obviously she Deirdre there is an active, very pushy agent. And that's what you want. You want an agent who is able to get out there and in. How many words is that? Four words. John Wick meets Taken. With that, she gets a deal. She gets a book deal. I mean, what more could you want from an agent? So go to Publishers Weekly and check out the recent book deals, and you will be impressed with some of the numbers that they're talking about. They say high six figures, low six figures, and we'll take five figures. Anybody would be happy with it. So it's also fun just to know that it gives you an idea of what is in the marketplace and what people are looking for. And I think you will like it. And again, go to, when you're finished with Publishers Weekly, go to Writer's Digest and check out the competitions, because they have some great competitions coming up. The August 1st one is right there. And then they have a short story one coming up in September. Remember, this is a way to get noticed. Even if you do not win the first prize for Writer's Digest, because they are the very, very best contest, the people who read it are active agents, people who are really in the business and know their stuff. Not one of these paid contests where you don't know who in the world is reading and where in the world your money is going to. With Writer's Digest, you know that those are real agents and or people who work in the publishing industry, editors and things like that. So that's why it is the premier contest, and the one that you want to, you know, if you have 10 short stories, submit them all. That's not a waste of money. It's wonderful to get noticed by anybody in Writer's Digest. And again, I was very happy that Daniel Silva was on today. It's always an honor to speak to somebody that big. I mean, he is big and he's all over the place. And the book is The Other Woman, and it is an eye-opener. And read it with the understanding that if and we know it's true that the Russians have been doing this for a long time, we have to try to imagine, in what other fields are they besides simply our intelligence network? Where else are they trying to infiltrate, and who are they out there? And so it's an interesting concept, and I hope that you will get the book. And I really, as I said, I love the Audible version. I was so impressed with it. And start with The Kill Artist, that's his number one book, and you will really get into the character. I love it because it's Gabriel Allon is an art restorer, art historian. And so it makes the books interesting on many levels. You have a lot of things to learn and a lot of things to think about all throughout all the series. And meanwhile, what can I say? One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in audible book. And if you're really lucky, and some people are, like Daniel Silva, you will see them on the big screen. And somebody, you'll be sitting there in the studio, and somebody will yell, "Lights, camera, action," and you will see your words spoken by actors. So it's up to you. You have to write a page a day, and in a year you'll have 365 pages. And I can tell you, Daniel Silva's book is really long. And so you are really in for a treat, and it's, well, I don't know, how many pages is that? Wow. 470 pages. Wow, 470 pages of absolute, absolute brilliant writing. So you can't go wrong with getting that book. And say something nice to somebody today, because you should do that every day. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he's always so good to me. And we will play Ace Atkins' Monday interview sometime next week. Okay, bye-bye now.